The next case is 95-2314 Diane Hicks versus Westinghouse Materials Company. Mr. DeMarco.
Good morning, Your Honors. Paul DeMarco, the appellant Diane Hicks. Your Honors, this is an appeal that arises from a peremptory strike that was exercised by the defendants against Donna Adams, a married 28-year-old black woman with four children, who described herself in her juror questionnaire as a mayor. Batson versus Kentucky is the seminal case for deciding when a peremptory strike against a black juror violates the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution.
What's your best authority in Ohio to apply the criminal standard announced in Batson to civil cases?
First of all, the Supreme Court case, U.S. Supreme Court case, Edmondson, applied Batson based on the same Equal Protection analysis to civil cases. I don't believe that this court has had an opportunity to test whether that application applies in Ohio as well, but I think the Equal Protection analysis is the same as stated in the Edmondson case. In all Batson cases, whether civil or criminal, we use the same three-step analysis. Step one, the party opposing a peremptory must establish a prima facie case of discrimination. Step two, the party exercising the strike must state a race-neutral explanation for the challenge strike. And step three, the trial judge must determine if the objecting party has established purposeful discrimination. Now, it's important under step three to remember that a striking attorney's explanation, although facially race-neutral, may nevertheless be deemed pretextual in step three, and that is sufficient to establish a denial of equal protection. Now let me return to the striking of Ms. Adams in this case. Pursuant to that, in step two, the trial judge visiting Judge William Gilley made defense counsel place on the record the reasons for the strike. And all parties in this case agree that by going straight to step two, Judge Gilley, in effect, mooted step one. All parties also agree that this is the case about step three. The question is, did Judge Gilley understand and fulfill his responsibilities under step three? Now, what specifically are those responsibilities? Again, Batson said that the trial court's obligation, its duty, is to determine whether whether purposeful discrimination has been established. Batson also said in order to perform this duty, a trial judge would have to conduct a, quote, sensitive inquiry into such circumstantial and direct evidence of intent as may be available. A later U.S. Supreme Court case, Hernandez versus New York, stated that as to step three, the decisive question will be whether the striking counsel's race-neutral explanation should be believed.
But wasn't there substantial compliance by the trial court, even though we may have had a few things not precisely on point, but didn't you basically get the meaning of the case and what he had to do? Didn't he basically get it?
Actually, Justice Smith, the Court of Appeals said no. The Court of Appeals said that.
I don't care what the Court of Appeals says. I don't know whether or not your observations of the trial court basically covered his obligations at that level.
No, I think the trial judge really did misunderstand Batson. And he misunderstood the significance of Batson, and he misunderstood his role under Batson. And let me tell you why. When plaintiff's counsel rose following the striking of Ms. Adams and said he would like to make a motion against the striking of black jurors, and the plaintiff's counsel began to discuss Batson, Judge Gilley interrupted and said, I'm aware of that, but the only thing that it requires is an explanation on the record. That is contrary to Batson. Certainly, what I think he was trying to boil Batson down to step two, putting on the record. And in this respect, what he did falls squarely within a number of other cases that we cited, which resulted in reversal. And these are cited, I think, on pages 16 to 19 in our brief. But let me talk about a couple of them very quickly. State versus Tuck. State versus Tuck, the trial judge indicated that she felt the purpose of the Batson cases was to create a record for appeal. That's what Judge Gilley was essentially saying here, too. State versus McRae, the Minnesota case, the judge held the striking party to the standard of you only have to articulate on the record your explanation. He didn't test it. State versus Robinson, another Ohio case, the judge clearly felt that it wasn't his province to test, just as in this case. And so I think it is the case.
But you take that out of context, I think. I mean, that Judge Gilley said that that's what you have to do, put on the record. But then after they put all of this on the record, Judge Gilley, as I read the briefs, came to a conclusion. And so he did fulfill step three.
Well,
State versus Tuck was my case. I had to go back and I had to put on the record again the reasons. And I did find in that case that even though the counsel may have made statements that sounded right, I didn't believe them and I felt that the reason was to exclude a black and I reversed it on Tuck. But as I read what Gilley's doing, he took that third step and said, okay, here's your explanation, and I accept them as being racially neutral. Did he take that third step?
I don't think he did, Justice Stratton. And I will talk about the Tuck case, because I think what you did in the Tuck case on remand is the model for how a judge should treat his step three inquiry, evaluation, analysis, and ruling. We don't find anywhere in here, for example, that Judge Gilley asked the questions that you asked of the attorneys. You, for example, in the Tuck case, appeared to question one of the attorneys as the basis for the strike. That did not occur in this case. You probed underneath, as you said in that case, simply the fact that a race-neutral explanation was presented is not enough to support a Batson challenge. The court, in its discretion, must also accept the same. And as you said, the court must be a jealous guardian of even subtle and insidious forms of discrimination. I would submit to you that Judge Gilley did not achieve anywhere close to that level of inquiry or analysis. Let's go back and look at what happened.
That's the real standard, then, whether us, as the judges up here, reading Gilley's words, believe he took that step. That's the real question.
It is a standard. We are proffering an alleged error of law that he applied the wrong standard, and this court can determine whether he did or not. And what I'm saying is, with respect to his analysis, if you look at it, the defendant stood up, proffered three explanations for the strike. At that point, there was some give and take back and forth about one of the explanations, the education explanation. At that point, Judge Gilley permitted the plaintiff's counsel to begin going through the questionnaires to pull out any that would show that the education explanation was a pretext.
And that would seem to show that Gilley was weighing the validity of that explanation.
You would think so, except he kept the process short. What he did, as that process was going along, another of the plaintiff's attorneys, trying to bring him back to Batson, his role under Batson, tried to talk to him about the Edmondson case. He indicated a lack of understanding as to why Edmondson applied. And then before plaintiffs could present the pretext evidence that is in our brief and is in the questionnaires, Judge Gilley all of a sudden said, we will accept the statement as complying with the federal court rule. The defense attorney stood up and said, wait a minute, it's not federal court rule, Your Honor, just so you understand. He said, well, whatever you have there, the citation, the Supreme Court decision. So he cut short the process of demonstrating the pretext that you see in our brief and you see in the recitation of the events in the Tuck case. I don't believe that he really was considering his role as a second guesser. I think what he was doing was making a record, and that once the record was made, you'll note that he was allowing the parties to go back and forth on it, but he did not await any evidence on pretext. He did not rule on any evidence of pretext. The only thing he said in that intervening time, I believe, was to point out to the defense attorney that he might want to add something to the record as he was making his record. He might want to say that this is not racially based. Well, he was concerned. He was the guardian of the record rather than, as you put it in the Tuck case, the guardian of the Equal Protection Clause. So I think what we have here is a situation in which this court should draw the same conclusion that the Court of Appeals drew, that Judge Gilley, quote, misunderstood the purpose of and the inferences permitted by the Batson line of cases. The problem with the Court of Appeals decision was where they went from there. The Court of Appeals decision said, okay, we recognize he misunderstood the applicable law when he let the strike stand. And let's not create any confusion. He let the strike stand. If you want to call that a ruling, that's fine. They conceded they misunderstood the law when he let the strike stand. But then they said, we have to defer to him, we have to review this for clear error. In doing so, however, I think they overlooked the clearest error of all, which is what they had just said, that he misunderstood and misapplied Batson. What is curious about how the Court of Appeals gets itself out of that conundrum is that the Court of Appeals then puts itself in Judge Gilley's place. The Court of Appeals essentially says he missed the proper standard. We, from where we sit, believe that the reasons offered were valid and race neutral. You remember, Judge Gilley never said the words race neutral, never applied that analysis, never said that the reasons given were valid. Those come up for the first time in the Court of Appeals. So the Court of Appeals, in this case, was the substitute for the analysis that Batson says is within the exclusive province of the trial judge. The trial judge is the one who's supposed to be making the evaluation. What's he supposed to be evaluating? He's supposed to be evaluating the state of mind of the striking attorney based on credibility and demeanor. That's not something that three appellate judges sitting in Cincinnati can say from a distance. Look to them like it was valid and race neutral.
Okay, counsel, let's say you got into this and the trial attorney has had a rule of thumb on peremptories. There doesn't seem to be anything else that just sticks out about jurors, which is frequently the case, that I'm going to take off anybody who just doesn't seem to have the capacity to understand the complexities of this case. That's a tough thing to say out loud as to a reason for excluding the juror. It may be a good reason, but that's a tough thing to say. I guess my question is, can't there be some things that are race neutral but are just so unpleasant to say in terms of counsel's reaction to prospective jurors that they're best left on set?
From a societal standpoint, I might agree with Your Honor. From a legal standpoint, Batson is directly to the contrary. Batson mandates that if an attorney is harboring racial bases for excluding the juror, the way to find that out is to make the attorney express what may be hurtful, what may be unpleasant. There are many, many Batson cases. attorney does stand up and say things that you and I might regard as unpleasant and not race neutral. And Batson contemplates that those things are said. Batson can't work unless the courts force the attorneys to get up and say those things and defend their strikes. Batson also can't work unless the trial judge takes the next step. And if, for example, and this is widely acknowledged too, that Batson explanations are often practiced. Because there's a developed body of law in which, you know, unkempt hair and things like that are all supposedly race neutral, so it's not unusual to hear the practiced explanation for it, lack of attentiveness, things like that. But that's why the judge is so critical, because the judge is supposed to prod, the judge is supposed to look into the attorney's state of mind. And that didn't happen in this case.
What do we do with the judge's explanation of titled racially discriminatory jury selection? I guess that was a trial judge's statement. Is that correct?
I'm not sure what you're referring to.
No, the Court of Appeals referred to the court's written explanation found in its decision on appellant's motion for a new trial as a heading racially discriminatory jury selection.
Yes.
And the judge refers to Donna Adams as, apart from her want of normal secondary education, was in the court's opinion not capable of following the path of evidence in the case. And then Usha, he has a reference there to the fact that she's not part of the, wasn't the protected class, and that whatever, whether the trial judge is correct or not, but she had another dispute about this, that she had a relationship through her husband, a close friend, and a TV program that relates to the substantive issue. What do we do with that?
I think the TV program may have related to another jury, Your Honor. Chief Justice Moore, let me respond to your question about the motion for new trial and the judge's ruling on it, because I think you have to look at the first two lines of the motion, the ruling on the motion for new trial. Because there again, Judge Gilley is showing that he's not really applying facts the way it's supposed to be applied. He said at the beginning of that decision, whatever may have been in the minds of counsel for either party, the court was not indulging in an effort to impanel a racially imbalanced jury. The problem with the analysis that comes after that is it's the court's analysis. He's never looking at the mind of the defense counsel. Let me make another point about a motion for new trial, because the United States versus Skeeter, which we cite in our brief, said that when an improper Batson analysis is made at the time of the strike, court can't come along later in a motion for a new trial and clean it up because it's too late by then.
But is the judge's sort of independent reason for permitting the strike, is that not relevant if the judge decides on totally different reason than may appear on the record? He cites this not capable of following the path of evidence. He obviously thinks this juror was distracted or not interested or whatever.
Right.
Does that not save the strike of that juror?
No, I don't think it does. The problem is that was not one of the explanations given by the defendants. That was not one of the explanations to which the plaintiff's counsel could respond.
Well, but if we're looking at, if the goal of Batson is to produce a jury that is fairly selected and that certain persons are not eliminated because of race, then why is the judge's independent reason for permitting the challenge not relevant?
Well, first of all, it's not relevant here because it comes at the end of the trial when the plaintiff could have responded to it. Remember, step three, the plaintiff is bearing the burden to show that it's contextual. And something that comes up for the first time in a motion for a new trial decision isn't susceptible of challenge by the plaintiff. The plaintiff can only challenge things at the time of the strike, when the attorney whose demeanor is at issue is standing there, when all of the pretext evidence is laid out. Here, it is another ground that would not fit into Batson, because Batson is to decide if the reasons given are pretextual. So I think straying outside of those reasons at the end of the trial, when the plaintiff can't challenge it, is problematic. And would not pass muster. The only
You've used your time, Mr. DeMarco.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Harrison.
Exercise exercise of a strike is motivated by purposeful, intentional discrimination. And what the record shows is that Judge Gilley is looking to plaintiff's counsel, persuade me, show me. And when faced with that challenge and looking through the questionnaire, plaintiff's counsel are unable to point to a single juror in the box that has a comparable or less than level of education than Ms. Adams. And there's a reason for that. The reason for that is at the time of the peremptory strike to Ms. Adams, there was not a single juror, African American or Caucasian, in the box that had a less than or comparable level of education than Ms. Adams.
Well, but is that the Batson test? Lesser education?
No, that was absolutely not.
I mean, that's, if we go to that point, we're going to be
But when asked for race, facially valid race-neutral explanations for the strike, one of the reasons offered by Mr. Hawkins was the educational level of his juror. One of the issues that the Batson cases and those cases following it say is if you can show somewhere in the jurors that are sitting there in the box that there are similar Caucasian jurors with similar or less than comparable levels of education or work experience or any of the other factors given the explanation, then that is a factor that the trial court can look to. And in this case, the trial court is clearly looking to that.
Well, wasn't his reason, as I recall, someplace I read that his reason for that was that there was some evidence, and some of the evidence in this case was not, he struck me and she struck me in the rear end of the car, but there was some fairly technical evidence, so there was some interest in having jurors who had an education level that would be interested in and could understand the evidence being offered.
Yes, absolutely. This was a highly technical case that involved a death in the workplace, allegedly caused by injuries sustained at the Bernal facility, a facility that was highly publicized, highly litigated. Therefore, there was an extra caution being taken in this process. The process for Deere in this case was similar to that of a capital case, in that there were two stages. Voir dire took place over 2 days, with jurors being questioned individually, first about their knowledge of the Bernal facility. So care was taken, Batson was followed in this case. The standard for this court in reviewing is whether or not Judge Gilley was in clear error.
Well, then what you're saying is that the lack of education is a valid reason to not send them off the jury.
It's a valid race-neutral explanation that can be offered. When challenged in this case. I mean, in this case, when under Batson, once a peremptory challenge is made, you have to give a reason. And one of the reasons.
Does the court have to weigh the validity of the reasons given?
Under Batson, the burden is on the party objecting to the strike to show that the facially race-neutral explanation.
But the court doesn't have to accept that reason on face value.
No, it doesn't.
Can't the court say, what? That's ridiculous.
Right, absolutely. And that's what the court is asking the plaintiff's counsel in this case. Show me that there are other Caucasian jurors in the box with similar or less than comparable education as Adams. And they're unable to meet that burden. And certainly at stage two, as the Supreme Court in Burkett made clear, at stage two of the Batson analysis, the explanation offered may be silly, may be implausible, as long as it's facially race neutral. Then at the third stage of Batson, the burden then is to show, and for the trial court to conclude.
So you're saying that any silly reason whatsoever.
Only.
And then it shifts.
That's what the Supreme Court says.
Mr. Smith has a green tie on. I want to not.
And the Supreme Court says in Burkett that at stage two of the Batson analysis, Your Honor.
That would be enough to get you to stage two?
No, that would be enough according to the Supreme Court.
That he has a green tie on? That's
why?
You're giving the trial court absolutely no credit for having any sense whatsoever.
No, I think what happens. Your Honor, what happens immediately upon the offering of that
explanation? Are you saying that this trial court is deficient in its reasoning, in its thinking process?
No, not at all, Your Honor. In fact, this trial court followed what it was supposed to do under Batson. It asked for the appellants in this case to meet their burden, and they failed, and the trial court made a finding.
So to make it clear, you're saying that you just can't give any silly old reason why you're knocking them off. It has to have some reasonable and rational basis to it for the case that you have before you.
I think there has to be some relationship to the case before you.
Well, we're in number one, lack of education, and you can knock everybody off.
Well, in this case,
the
this
whole
case,
I have a few more things to say. You can knock everybody off in the whole just go down fifth grade, you're not smart enough. Seventh grade, you're not smart. You can just do it automatically then.
In this case, Justice Wayne, as Justice Murray pointed out, one of the problems in this case was this was a case involving highly technical evidence. And there was a reason to be concerned.
Is there something that says somewhere that says in a highly technical case, a lack of education, you can be knocked off for no reason for that reason? Is there something I missed somewhere?
Your Honor, once the Batson challenge is made, and you have to come forward with a facially race-neutral explanation, that explanation needs to be tied to the case. It needs to be race-neutral and somehow tied to the case. In this case, that's what happened. I'd like to allow Mr. Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Harrison. Mr. Haters.
I'd like to address first Justice Sweeney's issue about the lack of education. I think lack of education, whether or not that provides a valid case for race-neutral reasons, deals really with if that had been an objection or a motion to strike the cause, having limited the fact that that reason. But in this case, since the case did deal with highly technical issues, since this case did deal with issues that the general public may not be familiar with, it was a valid racial reason to strike someone for outdoors. Because I think in this case, it was 10 days of testimony. And in this case, we were concerned with people who wouldn't be able to follow the path of the evidence, who wouldn't be able to follow the expert opinions that were raised in this case. In fact, I think that's the reason that the court at the very beginning decided to go with a two-step voir dire. First, to decide who was aware of the Bernal facility, and to decide who may be tainted by that. And second, then we ask for the individual strengths and weaknesses of each potential juror. I think one of the things that is important in this case is to look at the facts as they were brought up by Mr. Hawkins. Why did he object? Why did he not strike Ms. Adams? First, because of lack of education. If you look at the panel, Ms. Adams is the only member of that panel who had less than high school education. And I think this board also takes recognition of the fact that high school education does mean something. Answer something, especially when you go to or review cases dealing with someone with a disability. Someone who has a high school education is usually treated differently than someone who's not. So I think that is a valid reason.
Isn't it fair to say that every person, everybody in this room, has peers that are both maybe more bright and some that are less bright than each of us?
I think that, especially coming from me, I believe that's true.
And if that's fair to say, I'm going to use me as the example, and I don't want to personalize the viewers, but let's just assume everybody that's the case. And I guess we probably have to find the smartest person in the whole world or the least smart person in the whole world. So let's just assume, for the purposes of argument, that there are lesser and greater to all of us. Is that a reason to say that we don't have a jury of our peers? The command is you should have a jury of your peers.
Your Honor.
I mean, why don't we go out and get five PhDs in organic chemistry to sit on this jury?
Your Honor, I think that's part of the issue with the jury of our peers. I think part of the issue here is the jury who can understand the facts of the case. And that may not be your peers. If you are a fifth grade educated person, and you're dealing with a case about radiation exposure and understanding it, I think the parties to both sides who wants to can understand the case and decide on the facts of that case and understand the facts of the case.
Well, we could say that in every case.
We could. We could. I agree with you. It could be said. But I think the process, although it's imperfect, I think the process does, and the process, especially in this case, was intended to provide a fair and impartial jury. I don't think that you could say that we had any other intent. One other issue that I think that should be raised is that if you look at the evidence of trial court, Judge Gilley does mention later on when he's dealing with strikes, the fact that Ms. Adams did not seem to be able to follow the path of the evidence. that she did not seem to be as alert as a subsequent potential juror. And at that point, there was no evidence put forth by the plaintiff, by the appellants. They did not contest that issue at that time. They took it on face value and did not raise anything to say, no, that she's wrong. She was able to follow the evidence. In fact, I think that is important in this case. If you look at the questionnaire, I think there were other reasons also. She was not employed at the time of the trial, and that made her different than the other jurors. All of the other jurors were either employed or in retirement. That in itself leads to the issue of her level of sophistication. Having not worked, that may raise the issue of whether she would understand workplace issues. So that was another reason that was given. Having another reason was borne out by the facts of the case. Based on all of the evidence, based on all of the facts here, I think that it's clear that the trial court didn't conduct proper inquiry into the basis for the strike. And I think that the decision of the trial court, the court of appeals should be fine.
Thank you, Mr. Haters. Mr. DeMarco, you've used your time, but take 30 seconds.
Thank you. Very quickly, Your Honors, just so there's no misunderstanding, there were four jurors in the veneer who had the same or less education than Ms. Adams. I'm sorry, three others. Lest we conclude that this was a blue ribbon jury or anything that these gentlemen ended up with, six out of the 10 jurors had high school education. No more. Also, was there anybody on the eventual 10 who had less education? Yes, Mrs. Kaplan had less education than Ms. Adams. And like Ms. Adams, she was not working at the time of trial. I just heard Mr. Haters say that Ms. Adams never worked. There is no evidence of that. There is no evidence in the record.
Well, what they meant was the questionnaire indicated that she hadn't put down any employment, and we know that. I mean, that's, yeah.
I just want to make sure that's clear for the record, because that was one of the misrepresentations that was made by Mr. Hawkins, which I believe went to his credibility, but was never measured by Judge Gilley. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.